Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, March 7th. How are we doing this morning? So glad to be joining you where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, and you can listen to us from anywhere online at 883wppb.org. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and turned into a podcast. And I'm delighted to be broadcasting from the Arnold Palmer Invitational at Bay Hill Golf and Country Club here in Orlando, Florida. And Bay Hill, very special place because it's where Arnold Palmer, golf's greatest ambassador, hung his hat. Mostly in the winter time when he was not in his hometown of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, or playing golf, traveling the world and just so busy with appearances, et cetera, et cetera. But he did spend a lot of time at Bay Hill. And his memory is really all over this area here. It's just wonderful to see how they have preserved his legacy and his memory at Bay Hill year-round, but particularly during this Arnold Palmer Invitational. It wasn't even known as the Arnold Palmer Invitational until the name was changed. It was the Bay Hill Invitational. And then the tournament was changed to honor Arnold Palmer in 2007 at the suggestion of the Palmer family. And it's just impressive. The Palmer organization oversees the entire production. So obviously, along with the PGA Tour, they oversee this tournament, this PGA Tour stop, the second stop this year on the Florida swing. Amy Saunders, Arnold Palmer's daughter, and her family, including her son, Sam Saunders, who's actually a pro golfer and competing this week, they've done a remarkable job maintaining Arnie's legacy and memory in golf, not only here at Bay Hill, but at, all throughout Orlando with the Arnold and Winnie Palmer Children's Hospital, and just really do a great job preserving his name in all of golf. But particularly when you're walking around Bay Hill, there's, you see the golf bag, the Arnold's golf bag on the range in memory of him. You see the statue, the gorgeous bronze statue of Arnold Palmer. You can't walk by that statue without getting a picture taken on it. So it's just they do a wonderful, wonderful job because Arnie was the kind of individual who was very hands-on. He would stop and say hello. He would shake your hands. He would give anybody an autograph who came up to him. He'd go out and play golf, join a threesome if they were looking for a fourth. And he did that almost every day when he was still, playing. He was very accessible. His office was right there on the second floor at Bay Hill. And I remember visiting him there, and he was signing autographs and just, took the time to chat with me. And I was told he spent 3 hours a day signing his autograph to various memorabilia that people would send him. Just extraordinary people skills and charisma. And I went to visit him up in Latrobe after the U.S. Open at Oakmont. And it was literally a couple months before he passed. And he was at his desk, and he was very happy to see me. And it took him a little bit of effort to get up to shake my hand, but he did. And we had a lovely chat, and I was told he was signing autographs for 3 hours after I left. So, just that's what Arnold Palmer was all about. He was a people's person. He put golf on the map from a marketing standpoint, from a TV standpoint, with his handshake with Mark McCormick. They literally created the sports marketing business. I could go on and on about Arnold Palmer. The great news is, at this tournament, his memory and legacy lives on. And this morning, we're going to talk to Robert Gomez. Robert Gomez will forever be remembered as winning the tournament here at Bay Hill in the most spectacular fashion ever. Back in 1990, Gomez holed a 7-iron for an eagle on the par 4 18th, the 72nd hole, to win the tournament and beat Greg Norman for the title. Gomez has lived in Bay Hill for years. He plays in this PGA Tour event. He did not make the cut, but he has special memories of Arnold Palmer and of Bay Hill when Arnie was here, and he'll join us this morning. And in the second half of the show, all of you who listen to the show regularly and who listen to Hey LaGorrie, What's the Story? Back on WFAN, know that I've always been very intrigued by sports psychology. And Dr. Bob Winters brings 45 years of golf knowledge as a player, as a coach, and a researcher to the golf world, assisting players to achieve peak performance. Dr. Bob is the resident sports psychologist at the David Ledbetter Academy at Champions Gate. He's an author. He's a public speaker. He's worked with everybody from Brooks Koepka to Tony Finau, just on and on the list of athletes, male and female, that he's worked with. And I'm delighted to have him on in the second half of the show as we discuss a few of the issues that many elite athletes struggle with. I think you will find that interview fascinating. All right, let's look at the scores at Bay Hill going into this weekend of play. Tyrell Hatton and Sung Kang are tied for the lead at Bay Hill after two rounds. Hatton shot a 369. Kang birdied four of his last seven holes to card a 68. So at 7-under, they both lead Danny Lee by one. Lee had the low round of the day. He shot a 67. Rory McIlroy, he shot a plus 373. He's two shots behind. Matt Every was the first round leader with a 65, but boy, it was 18 shots higher yesterday, shooting an 83. He went from leading the tournament after the first day to not making the cut. He missed the cut by one. Phil Mickelson also missed the cut. He shot a 77 in the first round. He was on the cut line with three holes to play, but he finished with a double bogey, which sent him in the wrong direction, so he goes home early as well. It's the first time in 25 years that Phil Mickelson has missed four cuts before the Masters. Jason Day had to withdraw from this tournament during yesterday's second round. It happened last year here as well. Yesterday, he was playing the fifth hole. He was actually playing with Adam Scott and Brooks Koepka, and then he just packed up and rode back to the clubhouse, citing a back injury. His agent said that Jason's had some stiffness in his lower back on the putting green before the round. And all you golf fans know, he was hurt most of last year. He has not won a tournament since 2018 when he won the Wells Fargo Championship. He's had chronic back pain and an assortment of injuries, which also forced him to miss the President's Cup in his home country of Australia. So he struggled with his, he's been struggling with lower back issues, which is too bad because Jason Day, he's one of my favorite players, just such a nice guy. And he's so talented. Hopefully he can get, some treatment on this back and get back into contention at some of these events. In other golf news, and this is major news, Tiger Woods will not be playing next week in the Players Championship. His agent said his back is just not ready. So Tiger continues to struggle with his back issues. He's only played twice this year. He tied for ninth at Torrey Pines, and then he finished in last place at his own Genesis Invitational at Riviera. After shooting a 76 and a 77 there, he said his back was a little stiff. Well, he tweeted that he has to listen to his body and properly rest when needed. He says, "My back is simply just not ready to play next week. I'm sad to miss one of the best events of the season, our championship." Well, no word on what tournaments, if any, he will play before the Masters in April. You have the Valspar Championship at Innisbrook, which is north of Tampa. You have that after the Players' Championship. He actually tied for second there 2 years ago. Then there's the Dell Match Play in Austin, Texas, followed by the Valero Open in San Antonio. Woods never plays the week before the Masters, but it will be interesting if he plays at all before the Masters this April. as he's trying to rest his back and get it in shape to defend his Masters title and hoping to win his sixth Masters. Let's see what kind of shape he is in come April. Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. Peak Vision, P-E-A-K, Vision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. I am at Bay Hill for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. And look who I caught up with, the one and only Robert Gomez, who just got off the course. Hey, Robert, thanks so much for joining me today. And it's always great to run into you and Denise.
It's fun to be out here and always nice to see you for sure and hang out with you because you're so awesome coming to our event every year and hanging out with us and trying to raise money for the kids. And, you know, we're out here. It was a great day. A little windy, a little cool this morning, but it is what it is. It's still API week, and it's a lot of excitement, a lot of good play out there.
Robert, you live here. You won here. You had this incredible shot on 18 back in 1990, and so this has to be just so special for you, right? I mean, what does it mean for you to just have this home game every year and to just be a part of it?
You know, it's one of those things. I know they'd rather not have me out there because I keep shooting 100. I shot, I think, 84 today and 83 yesterday. But I'll tell you what, it's just fun being here. I live inside the community here and a member here at Bay Hill. So it's fun to be out there. We had a lot of people coming and watching, and I try as hard as I can. This golf course is just too long for me. I mean, number four today, it's a 246-yard carry to the fairway. Into the wind this morning, cold, ball's not carrying. I bounced it off the cart path just to get it into the rough to be able to lay up again. So,
You got that shot down, the cart path shot?
I'm trying because I might need it again next year. But I'm going to keep playing. I know the tour would probably rather not have me out here, but it's an invitational, and I want it. I get to come back. I'm going to keep coming back until they make me exempt on the Champions Tour for my rest of my life. Then I'm going to keep coming back here. No. So I want to be here because, you know, Mr. Palmer was, you know, he changed me a lot after getting to know him and watching the way he treated people, especially once I became a member here. I got to see him all the time coming in for breakfast and watching him and how he interacted with people. That's what you do. And the way he handled the fans, because, you know, he was such a big star, but he handled, I say handled, but not like he took care of people. Like, he always signed the autographs and always took pictures in when he's having breakfast. He'd get up from his seat and take pictures and say hi to him. And then he's on the range getting ready for the shootouts here. And people would come over and want pictures. And he would do that. And that's what you do. I mean, nowadays the tour is a lot different than it used to be. It's the money's way, way bigger. Sponsorships, all that stuff, and I hate to say it, but the kids nowadays that are playing, they don't understand what it takes to and why the tour is what it is and why they're playing for so much money. You know, I mean, Mr. Palmer knew what it was all about. They don't get it yet, I don't think. There's a few guys. I mean, Ricky Fowler understands the stuff that this tour is all about. Some of the young guys don't get it yet. And unfortunately, hopefully it'll keep going and they'll get it. But, you know, I just enjoy being around here, and I'm going to keep coming because I'm a past champion. I'm exempt for life. So until I die or I stop playing competitively, because I'm still trying to play Champions Tour. So as long as I'm playing competitive golf, I'm going to keep playing here.
Well, talking about winning here, just you have to relive the shot for us. I'm sure you, when every time you walk down 18, do you think about?
In 1990, it was, I do. And actually, yesterday, I was down almost, actually, I think I was to my plaque yesterday, which I haven't been to my plaque in a long time. It was downwind, but I was still down.
And you're complaining about, you know, you don't have the length anymore? That's pretty damn good.
It was way downwind. I got a new driver, and I'm hitting a little bit further. But I coming down the end, I'm a shot behind Larry Mize, Greg Norman. I hit a really good drive down right center of the fairway on 18, had 176 yards. Normally, it was a little bit right to left and downwind. I'm a fader of the ball, so I hit it left to right. So I'm thinking, just hit a little cut 6-iron. Would be perfect to the back right pin. And as I'm sitting there, Larry Mize is in the right rough, trying to figure out what he's going to do. So the longer he takes, the more nervous I got. I mean, I'm a rookie. I didn't know any better. So he lays up, or hits it in the back bunker left, I think, is what happened. But the longer he took, the more nervous I got. I said, when I get nervous, I just want to hit a hard shot. So I ended up deciding to change clubs. I had a 6-iron. I was going to hit a little cut 6. Decided to go back for the 7. Felt the wind right to left and helping a little bit. I thought I'd just hit a little draw, or I faded it, but I thought I'd try to hit a draw. And it just, you know, curled perfectly, went in the hole. Yeah, because I was going to be aggressive. I'm trying to win, trying to at least get in a playoff. And somehow it went in, and next thing you know, hey, I'm a champion.
Were you doing cartwheels out there?
No. My body wasn't made for that.
No, you didn't have a house here then, right?
No, I was still living in Vegas.
Right. So
I didn't move to Orlando till 2002. So.
Right. And obviously your success here was a big part of it. And how much was, you know, the fact that Arnold Palmer's meant so much to the game, how much was he a part of your decision to move here?
Well, I mean, I can't say that he was the decision for me to move here, because I just wanted to get out of Vegas. At the time I left, Las Vegas, as a professional golfer, travel was horrible. The airport was terrible, that kind of thing. The city grew so big, so fast, because I grew up there. I was born and raised in Las Vegas. Now there's a lot of players living there, and you know, a lot of them never grew up there, but they're living there now. I think the airport, I haven't been back in 12 years. So, but I think the airport has gotten better. And then the guys that are living there, they all have private jets, so they're flying in and out easy. It's an awesome place to live, but trying to travel when you're doing commercial. Older at Disney and Universal Studios, so I go all the time when I'm off and trying to do some stuff. I'll go in the morning for like 3 hours. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I love it.
Just walk around, go to some of the attractions.
Roller coasters, absolutely.
I love that, Robert. I didn't know that about you. See, we learn something new about you all the time. So going back to the younger, you know, kids, as you call them, and Arnold Palmer is such a charismatic ambassador for the game, and who spent so much time. We all have our Arnold Palmer stories. I was able to see him a couple months in La Trobe in his office before he passed, and he was signing then. He was spending 3 hours a day signing then. And you know, I had to help him get up from out of the chair. I didn't even want him to get up at that point, but he was such a gentleman. He stood up when and welcomed me, and we chatted for a good 20 minutes. And, you know, that was only a few months before he passed. But, you know, I'd known him his entire career and had seen him here. And I love the fact that he would go and play with people he didn't even know. If they needed a fourth, I'll play with you. And that was, you know, for the majority of his life, you know, even after he retired from playing professionally. So you hear so much about Arn Palmer, and you and I knew him pretty well, right? So what do you say? Do you feel like sometimes you want to just go to some of these young guys and say, let me have a chat with you. Let me kind of, you know, knock some sense into you.
You know, you can't. They grew up in a different era. They didn't know Mr. Palmer the way that I knew him. You know, as a kid in Vegas playing junior golf and all that stuff, we'd do putting contests and, you know, somebody be Arnold and Jack, and I was Trevino because I was Mexican. So, you know, we would be all these different, like, stars in putting, and this is for the U.S. Open and whatever. So the kids nowadays, they didn't grow up back then, so they don't understand it. And it's all the entitlement thing nowadays with the young people. You know, all these kids that grew up feeling like they were entitled to what they have. I mean, you know, when there's no discipline anymore, and there's, you know, in my opinion, these kids would be better off if they were, you know, you act up in a restaurant, you get spanked. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. I am that era. You know, I got spanked once in a while. When I got spanked, I didn't do it again. You know, so it's part of all of that. I'm getting off, but it's the entitlement thing, and I think that they just don't get it. They don't think when they get an exemption to an event, they don't think they need to play an offsite pro-am. They just think that they should be in the tournament. I'm a total different thing. You give me a spot somewhere, I'm going to do whatever you want me to do. That kind of thing. So you can't go to them, and the agents are bad, and, you know, all that stuff nowadays. It's like, hey, you don't have to do anything. We got you in. You're good. Yeah, it's not the way it works. And obviously, Mr. Palmer was different going back, way back when the tour was in Vegas. And the Champions Tour was in Vegas, or Senior Tour back in the day. I was a kid. I was carrying standard bearers. I was doing all that. I carried standard bearer for Arnold. I carried for a lot of the young guys back in the day. And then when Mr. Palmer was Champions Tour, he would sit there. I'd watch him on his cart signing every autograph. It was amazing, and that's how I've learned. This time in my career, it's a lot easier. Yes, early in my career, I struggled with it. Mm-hmm. If I had a bad day, I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't, you know, in the last, like, 10, 15 years, you know what? Whatever you need from me, I'm doing it.
Two more questions, because I know you have a lunch date, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me here. The tournament itself, what I love about the Arnold Palmer Invitational, brought to you by MasterCard, right? The signage is, I mean, they really up the ante, right, as far as signage goes and the marketing. But yet it still has that small town feel to it. They've managed to maintain that, which is really cool. Because, you know, a lot of the tournaments just, you know, it's grown, golf has grown so much. A lot of tournaments just haven't been able to do that. But I hope they can continue that. Do you know what I'm saying about? I mean, it's just quaint and still you can, and you see Arnold and Phil Arnold everywhere, which is important. Absolutely. There's Ricky Fowler's bag, and look, it's a Bay Hill custom made bag. I mean, I love that about Ricky Fowler. But you know, Arnold's everywhere here. The bag on the range in his honor, his bag. You know, and that's special.
It really is, and you see it with the big statue over here behind the first tee, and this is Arnold's club, and it's all about Mr. Palmer, and I call him Arnold. I you know, he's Mr. Palmer, but I knew him a little bit differently. So It is different. It's always his. It's always going to be the Arnold. Well, it's Arnold Palmer Invitational now, but it's always going to be his event. And, you know, I know Ricky. I just saw Ricky in the locker room, and he's wearing a cardigan. That's what Arnold used to wear. Wear cardigans, and it's like he. I think Ricky's one of the few guys, young guys, that gets it, and he understands the history of golf, and as golf goes, a history, Mr. Palmer is going to be, he's like up there with Jack and Byron Nelson and, you know, all these guys, Gene Sarah's and all these guys in the, you know, few past of golf. Mr. Palmer's right there. He's at the top. And I think Ricky has been one of those guys that's taken that and done a lot with it. I mean, I would, obviously, living right inside the, I would love to be, I know they do the ambassador thing every year here, and I would love to be the ambassador for this event. Granted, I'm not on the regular tour anymore, so I can't ask people to play, and I don't know these young kids anymore. I can't ask them if they'll come to the event. So I'm not the exact person to be an ambassador for this event. Per se,
I think you are, well, based on your, you know, you're here and you've won here and you knew Arnold Palmer so well. I mean, I think you'd be perfect. You want me to pitch that for you? I'm sure Denise is handling that already, right? You're an agent.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I understand in what they're doing and they're trying to do it differently. And like, again, I'm not a guy that can go on the regular tour and say, hey, come play, you know, API. Because I'm not out there. I don't know the kids nowadays. I mean, there's a lot of kids. I look on the range. I know none of them. I mean, there's very few. They probably don't know me either. Because a lot of these kids weren't even born when I won the tournament. So it's just I just love being here. And I'm going to keep playing as long as I can.
Last question, Robert, because I'm very involved in your event. I love it. The Robert Gomez Foundation does great work here in Orlando. Talk about your work with the foundation, and I'm just psyched to be back next October.
I know. It's so much fun. We do it's the Team Gomez Foundation, and we do a charity event, Chipping for Children, and we just have a four-day party with a little bit of golf, you know, the last day, and then we party that night too. So it's just a lot of fun, and we raise money for children's charities in Central Florida and elsewhere, not just in Central Florida. So, like, we'll donate money we have friends in Houston when they had all the floods, and some of their, you know, friends they knew, they lost, the kids lost everything. So we donate. It's got to be children, you know, that kind of thing. So we have a good time. We have a lot of celebrities come in. Obviously, you're there. You know, we've had Roger Clemens and Jim McMahon, and, you know, we've had Mark Bryan from Hootie and the Blowfish, John Cafferty from the Beaver Brown Band, Charlie Hune from Foghat. And, I mean,
the musicians you get are incredible. The music, all of a sudden, Foghat is playing, and I'm thinking, wow, I feel like I'm just, you know, at a concert.
Yeah, I know. It's so much fun. On, you know, the Friday thing, it's just a casual dinner with our celebrities and anybody that wants to come, people from out of town. Saturday is a VIP thing. You know, you've been there. It's a VIP in the suite, acoustic jam with our entertainers getting up and just singing. No backup, no nothing. They're just up there singing. And then Sunday, the big party and auction. And then this, and the music, country auction, live auction, then rock. And then Monday, golf, and we go back to the suite afterwards. It's again, we're so tired after drinking for 4 or 5 days. And but we raised a lot of money. We've... My wife Denise, you know, she's runs it all, and she does an awesome job. And I give her kudos because she has a regular job too, a real job. She has a real job, but people think that's all she does is the event. It looks like it because it's professional, right. But no, she and we have a great bunch of volunteers, and you know, the celebrities like yourself that, that come and support it, because we can't do events without the celebrities and the volunteers, and nobody that works with us, we have a board of directors, nobody that works with us gets paid. It's all volunteer work. So you can't, I mean, it's amazing what you can do when you do that and have people that believe in what you're doing.
Robert Gomez, the Team Gomez Foundation. You and Denise are very special people. So continued success, and great to catch up with you here on your home turf at Bay Hill. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. Peak Vision, PEAKVision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and my guest is Dr. Robert Winters, who is a sports psychologist, not only any sports psychologist, but he's been working with golfers, professional golfers, and doing his thing since 1977. And he has a book called Mistake-Free Golf, a first aid for your golfer's brain, and he lives right around the corner. So this tournament, the Arnold Palmer Invitational here at Bay Hill, is right in your own backyard. So it's good to see you at home here, Doctor.
And it's great to be on the show. You're just a living legend. It's great to be here. And you and I have known each other now for a few years. And so I'm just glad we can actually do this interview.
Well, I mean, this is the epitome of golf, Orlando, Florida, right? So tell me a little bit about your background. How long have you been here? I know you're working as the resident sports psychologist for David Ledbetter. So, I mean, you're so connected to the sport. Have you always been in Orlando, or what's your background?
Well, my background is I grew up in the middle of Midwest, Indiana. I played golf for Ball State University. I've played golf at every professional level, you know, both as a tour player, as a Champions Tour player, PGA Champions Tour qualifier. Helped start the Nike Golf Schools back in 1991, 92. The junior golf programs all over the nation. I was the assistant men's golf coach at the University of Virginia for 10 years, and been involved with golf all my life. You know, as a player, as a coach, so I became a sports psychologist many, many years ago in order to help my own game. So we always say, doctor, heal thyself. Well, that's exactly what I did. So everything that everyone is afflicted with, I have had. I've cured myself and cured everybody else. And it's been one great, great ride, Ann. Really.
I bet. I mean, I saw you at Rich Lerner's celebrity tournament last year. And everybody knows your name, Dr. Winters, in the world of golf. And, you know, you've coached some incredibly successful players. One, Brooks Koepka. I mean, the guy's a machine. You coached, you were his sports psychologist when he was a youngster and when he was at FSU. Talk a little bit about your work with Brooks Koepka.
Well, one of the things that his coaches, high school coaches and college coaches, knew that he had a temper. I mean, this guy wasn't just a golfer. He was an athlete, a baseball player. I think his father, Bob, you know, was a professional baseball player. So he had a real, like, in-your-face, chip-on-your-shoulder attitude. So as far as mental toughness, I mean, he got that both from his mom and his dad. His mother, Denise, fantastic woman, a cancer survivor. And he, you know, and his little brother, Chase, who's also, you know, a tournament golfer, plays on the European Tour and all over the world. They've been very, very close, great family. And that's where Denise said, I need some help with Brooks. He's got kind of an anger management issue problem. And it wasn't so much anger. He just gets frustrated. And that's really what great players do. When they get frustrated, when their results don't match their expectations, they get disappointed, disgusted, angry, and I'll tell you what, sometimes even depressed. And that's where we have to remove the expectations and start focusing on execution. And that was my work with Brooks. Now, if you listen to him to this day and time, he's always talking, I don't care about anybody else. I take care of me. It's about me, my ball, and the target, and we beat the golf course. And there's some other people who have done that who've been pretty successful, like Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus and Annika Sorenstam. But if you can actually beat the golf course, everything else falls in place.
And how hard is that to, you know, that to make that connection with a youngster who, you know, golf is such a frustrating sport, more than any other sport I can think of. How do you get somebody with that much talent not to be frustrated? Because golf is so different. You can hit a great shot 1 second. The next second, you could look like a total beginner. And this is a professional golfer, right?
Right.
So how does one make that connection to somebody so young to not lose your temper?
I think Lee Trevino said it best. He said, I'm only going to take a lesson from somebody that can beat me. And so when I start seeing these junior golfers through my junior programs, the Ledbetter Academy, Nike Golf Schools, I sort of talk the talk and walk the walk. So I will go out and role model, sort of what we call participant modeling. I will show them, this is what I need you to do. A lot of people call me the original sugar pop guy, all right? They call me, you know, pretty positive. But I'm not positive. I'm very purposeful. I'm very realistic. I'm very specific. But I say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And when young people, especially, you know, the juniors, because they're so critical, and they sort of discern things very, very easily, very quickly, and they size you up. When they find out I'm just not a psychoanalyst or psychologist, I'm an athlete, I'm a coach, I'm a real person, and I walk the walk, talk the talk, and I do exactly what I say I'm going to do, and they go, huh, this sounds fun. Plus, I keep it enjoyable, you know, keep it lighthearted, and that's why we say they're fundamentals. It's fun, duh, mentals. That's really what we call it. Yeah, that's how we keep it fun. We just keep it, hey, it's just mental. Let's go out and have a great time. And when you help people have a great time, whether they're learning something in life and business or whatever, they will be invested. And that's really what I do.
I like that. Keeping on the Brooks Koepka theme for a second, because I always thought he was an amazing talent. He did not get the recognition early in his career after he won his first U.S. Open, his first major title, Erin Hills. When he went to Shinnecock as the defending champion, he was not too happy because he wasn't getting the recognition that most defending champions would get. I think it was because he was coming across, you know, with that chip on his shoulder to the media. So I'm not sure if you've worked with him recently. Now, obviously, people know who Brooks Koepka is. They're giving him all the credit in the world for winning, you know, what, 4 majors at this point in a very short period of time. But that kind of carried over that chip to the way he was dealing with the media.
Well, I think sometimes you like to back yourself into a corner because you fight your way out of it. And Brooks has heard from me from a long time, as I, all of my tour players and all my college players, is that if you're the defending champion of something, of any major, of any tournament, you have to give up the defense. Quit defending something that they cannot take away from you. I mean, if you won that 1 year, let's go out, let's get the next one. Let's quit being the defending champion. I would say the same thing to Tiger Woods right now about going down to Augusta here in a few weeks. Give up the defense. You've already won this several times. Let's go out and get this one. And so you're always moving forward. I always like to call it sort of a panzer tank approach. It's just tanky, 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 tank. You're just moving one after one after one, and you're just not holding on to anything. You're always moving forward. So that's a very smart, aggressive strategy, because everyone's always asking people, how do you close the deal? How do you win? When you let go of winning and perform and execute and play it one after one until you're done, winning tends to come knocking at your door.
And you don't care what if you've gotten the recognition that you feel you deserve, because it's not about that. It's about going out there and playing the best you can.
Oh, absolutely. So I think, you know, Brooks sort of likes this, you know, oh, hey, you know, I'm not getting the recognition. It puts him in a position of, I'm going to show you this. And that's really what Gary Player said years ago. He said, you always want to thank the people who are very positive, very supportive of you. He said, but you also want to thank the people that say, no, you're not good enough. We're going to overlook you, because you just can't wait to show them up. And I think that's kind of really what Brooks Koepka does. And I think It's also really what one Patrick Reed is doing right now, because he has sort of backed himself into an unbelievable corner, and really he has himself, his family, and his own thoughts. And that's really what sort of gives him that cocoon, and that's what gives him that bubble of concentration. It's going to be me, you know, my ball against the world. And so far he's been pretty successful with that.
Do you work with Patrick?
No, I do not. But if he called, you know, I would probably have to consider it, because he really is an interesting case study, interesting athlete. And a lot of people have said, wow, you know, what's going on there? So I don't really like to speculate on this. I think time will be, you know, the ultimate judge here. But I got to tell you, I mean, here he is, a major champion. He's won a lot of these world championships. He's a hell of a player. Some people call him Captain America. Some people call him, I think David Faraday called him Captain Oblivious, because he's really not even aware of his own detrimental self-image. Sometimes people are famous. Sometimes they're infamous. But that's the great thing about this sport. You got different strokes, different folks, and no one person is alike. So that's what I love about my job, because every day I come into my office or people call me up, it's something new. It's something that we have to custom tailor for them. And I work on the human being model. I don't really have one size fits all. But I do know one thing, if everybody's listening to this broadcast, if there's one thing you can do, is the first thing before you step up on that tee or on that floor or on the ice, is that, are you going to believe in your talent? Because that's the number one mental mistake we have in life, is that we have our own self-doubt. And where's that doubt created? It's within our own minds. And I always tell people, it's the first thing I ask them.
I think he knows, obviously, what's going on. But I don't think anybody does a better job at using the distractions and tunneling those distractions into focusing on wanting to play great golf. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. Some people might let that really affect them on the course and off the course. All the things going on off the course affect their play. But Patrick Reed almost feeds off of it.
Well, when people ask me, they go, well, what do you do? Is golf 100% mental? Is it 50-50? And I tell them, I thought this was pretty interesting. I said this in my a book before Mistake-Free Golf, The 10 Commandments of Mind Power Golf that I had written. I said golf is 100% mental and 100% physical. And I realize now that Ben Hogan had said that 25 years earlier, but I thought I was pretty smart at that time. But now I'm going to say it's 100% mental, 100% emotional, 100% physical, and now, Ann, I'm going to say it's 100% compartmental. Is that I think players, any athlete, any great business people, people who are very successful, they compartmentalize. They can shut out and disconnect and focus on what they have to do. Because if you can do that, then you have total control. You see, that's the whole problem with doubt. Doubt is our number one performance enemy. And if people can actually get you to doubt your talent, then they can control you. All right, so that's why I'm always trying to give people, you know, get in control. Control what you can control. Forget everything else. Get in your little bubble of concentration, and let's go out and let's perform, and let's find out how great we can be.
Vince Lombardi, I love it. I'm ready to go out there and win the game,
absolutely,
man. Can we keep talking about this? You got me all pumped up. Well, Mistake-Free Golf, First Aid for Your Golfer's Brain, came out a couple years ago, and it's a gem. It has so many pearls of wisdom in it, and your focus really is on the 9 most common mental mistakes that golfers make, or I would assume any athlete would make. You say self-doubt is one of them. What are some of the others?
The other ones, you know, I try to be perfect. I hit the shot when I know I'm not ready. I worry about my reputation. I worry about my score. I have too much thinking. I've got helmet fire. I've got all this stinking thinking going on in my head. So I address each one of these, because so many of these self-help psychological, sports psychology books in particular always talk about sort of this is the condition. But they never say, this is the treatment. This is what you have to do. That's why I say, this is first aid for your golfing brain. This is what you need to do. And that's what made Nike so successful. They had 3 words, just do it. And that's really what I'm doing in this book. I'm giving you a very nice prescription for success. And at the end of every chapter, I say, I need you to do this. And if you can do these things and really comply and do the things I'm asking of a player to do, you will have success. And that's really what, you know, confidence is all about. Confidence isn't just thinking confidence. It's actually attracting confidence. It's creating confidence. But it's doing the things that you have to do in order to be successful. And if you're successful at little baby steps at a time, at the end, the residue of all that success will be what we call long-term enduring confidence. And that's really what I do. I build confidence.
I love that. You build confidence. So you could be talking to CEOs. Absolutely. You could be talking to race car drivers. You could be talking to doctors, nurses. I mean, I think that concept is so important because everybody has that self-doubt, Dr. Winters. How do you tear that down in somebody?
How do I tear it down?
The self-doubt.
The self-doubt, well, self-doubt starts with a little seed of self-doubt. People go, you know, am I really that good? You know, why don't I have what everybody else does? Everybody's always looking on the other side of the fence. And they start sort of tearing themselves down. You don't have the option or the luxury of thinking negative thoughts. You know, what you say to yourself is what you become. I mean, that's the strangest secret of all. Earl Nightingale said that back in 1953. So what I'm trying to do today is say, hey, you improve your self-talk, you improve your self-thought, you really say, this is what I want to be. And I hear a lot of these self-help gurus say, well, you've got to fake it till you make it. I don't like that. I don't like that because that's false, you know, deception, creating a false perception. I say, do it until you become it. And you have to do the little things every day in some little manner to help you become more competent so you can become more confident in everyday life. And it just transfers into every area of life. And that's why I love to speak to corporations. I love to speak to businesses. Whoever, you know, really wants to have a sort of a different view on confidence, you know, let them come to Dr. Bob Winters.
Is there a problem being overconfident?
There can be if you believe that you're too big for your britches, so to speak. So we always talk about sort of this confidence bias. Here's the point, and Ann, I'll tell you straight up, is that I think being overconfident is not as big a problem as being underconfident. Because if you're always underconfident, you're always underperforming, and you're never giving yourself a chance to find out how great you can be. I always love it, you know, when somebody walks in to a social gathering, and they may not be, you know, the prettiest, the most glamorous, the person has the most bling, but you can just see that positivity, that confidence, and they come out and go, you know what? I may not be the hottest thing since sliced bread, but I'm pretty hot anyway, you know. And you have that, and they come out. They exude that self-confidence, that self-image that says, I like who I am. And when it all comes down to confidence, it means, are you comfortable in your own skin? Do you like who you are? Do you like, you know, where you're at? Do you like what you aspire to be? And are you moving towards that direction? And that's really what I think, you know, this life's all about, is finding out how great we can be.
I always took issue with people in the media or fans who thought if a player said something that sounded a little cocky, that, oh, what's that? Why should he say that? You know, Brooks years ago, you know, came across cocky. I always defended him because if you want to be a champion, you have to have that overconfidence. I didn't find it to be offensive at all. I just found it to be, as you say, an example of somebody who really believes in themselves. Now, you know, it may be keep it to yourself, or you're going to offend somebody, but or maybe not even worry about it.
You see, here in America, especially America, and even in Australia, Australia calls them the tall poppies. Oh, you think you're better than us, huh? And they always want to sort of cut you off at the knees. So we have sort of a tough problem here. We love our athletes. We love our heroes to perform unbelievably well. But at the same time, we want them to be unbelievably humble. And those two things don't really go together. And so when we're trying to get athletes pumped up, or motivated, or just in a psychological, emotional state to perform at a very, very high level, you can't be sitting here saying, now, I want you to be cool, calm, an average. I want you to be just like everybody else, because if you are, you're helping them become very mediocre. And I've never had anybody call me up in the middle of the night and say, Dr. Winters, I just made the cut here at the Bay Hill Invitational. There wasn't anybody following me. It was the most relaxed, most composed round I've ever had. Can you help me become the most average guy on tour? You know, and the same thing for the ladies. No one calls me up for that. Everyone says, I want to be able to come down the stretch, feel like I'm ready to throw up and just jump out of my shoes. Because when you're feeling like that, that means you're in the hunt. That means you're doing some great stuff. That's confirmation that what you've been doing all day is working. So we have kind of a hard time. And what most people don't realize is that having sort of a healthy arrogance means I believe in what I believe in. You don't have to like me, but I like me. And I've always said this. It's not what other people think about you that's most important. It's what you think about you in the final analysis. And that's about you mastering you, and that's what greatness is all about. It's about you being in control of your thoughts, your emotions, and your life. And is your life taking you where you want to go?
I love that. Now, aside from the confidence issue, what else, what would you say is another top issue that you have to communicate about and deal with these tour players, be it men or women? What would you say is number two?
It's the fear. But it's just not the fear of failing, and it's not the fear of embarrassment, even though Jack Nicklaus said to me one time his greatest fear was being on, like, the major championship, like at the Masters, and dubbing it off the first tee. He never really wanted to embarrass himself. In fact, I was talking with Sam Snead about 3 weeks before he would go to the Masters to hit the ceremonial ball. He would be practicing for 2-3 weeks. You know, hitting all these golf balls because he wanted to get up there. And he would always, you know, bend over and go, oh, like, you know, he's like an old man. No, he was a real savvy old fox. He knew exactly what he was doing. And then he'd step up and he'd rip it down there, 250, 260, and everybody would go, oh, my. But the greatest fear that these athletes have is the fear of inaccessibility. They will not be able to access the tap because, as you know, as a player, and you go on the golf course and you come in and people go, wow, Ann, that was a great round you had. And you're sitting there thinking, well, thank you. That's, you know, the socially thing. But in your mind, you're going, if you knew how well I really played, it would be a totally different story. And I think that's what happens to a lot of players out here.
That's fascinating. So they're really overachievers if they're thinking like that.
I don't think they're overachievers. I think they're achieving a certain level of excellence that they feel that they can actually do every day. So again, are they misplaced expectations? Are their expectations too high? Because an expectation, Ann, is a preset standard of performance that says, this is the way things have to be. This is the way it should be or could be. And so what I'm trying to do is that expectations a lot of times get in your way. It's like going to a 5-star restaurant, and you go to this 5-star restaurant. You're expected to have great ambiance, great food, great service. And anything less than that is like, well, that's disappointing because we set ourselves up for failure. And that's really what distorted perfectionism is all about. We have this unbelievable expectation. We've all played with players who, you know, they hit a great shot, and everybody goes, great shot. And the perfectionist will come back and go, I hit it off a little at the toe. I didn't hit it all that good. They're never satisfied, so they never get any good juju, any good mojo, out of a good shot.
Right, right.
So, and they're very hard, you know, to sort of work with. So the athletes, you know, that at this elite level that we're talking about here, like at Bay Hill, getting ready for the Players and the Masters, I mean, they are the best of the best. This is, you know, Top Gun, and when you're like a Top Gun pilot, you have an edge. You have to have an edge. Because if you don't, I mean, you're gone. Because the difference in the sport, in the world of sport, and in the corporate world, and at the very tip top, you know, if you aren't on your game, someone else is going to go around you. And they're going to pass you like you are standing still. Because in this game, an individual sport, it's just you versus the golf course. Everybody says, well, I've got to beat everybody else. Well, everybody's trying to beat everybody else, but it's really not you versus you. It should be you for you. You giving yourself the good stuff so that you can actually, you know, play the very best that you can.
Well, what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you accurately is, I mean, these are elite athletes. They have expectations for themselves. Somebody says, great shot. They're thinking, ah, I could have done so much better. So are you trying to make them appreciate the good smell of the roses? But they wouldn't really be who they are if they're going to settle for that. You know what I'm saying?
I do. It's a thin line between appreciation and acceptance and then critiquing. You know, what we always say in sports psychology, it shouldn't be, you know, self-destructive criticism. It should be a positive critique. You know, what did I do well right there? But at the end of the day, what do most people do? Oh, I did this wrong. I did that wrong. And so in hindsight, everything's 20/20. I woulda, coulda, shoulda. What I want my athletes to believe is that this is the best I could do today. I have to accept it. I may not like it. This is the whole thing about acceptance. I may not like it, but it is what it is. And I can't cry over spilt milk. And I'm always telling people that if you want to watch the greatest golf psychology movie in the world, watch Disney's The Lion King. And people go, you got to be kidding. I go, no. Because in The Lion King, when little Simba goes across the elephant graveyard and he's, you know, someplace he didn't want to go, he meets, you know, Timon and Pumbaa, who say, wow, why are you crying? And he says, why he's crying. And he looks at them and goes, well, why are you guys so happy? He goes, because we live by the Zimbabwean philosophy of Hakuna Matata. Since we're in the land of Disney, I'll use Disney here. And it means no worries. Whatever's happened's happened. I'll put it behind me and move forward. And that is a metaphor for life. That's what it is, what it is. Learn from it. Have the maturity of your memories. Have the maturity of that experience and accept it and appreciate it and move on. So for an elite athlete like here at Bay Hill, they've got to appreciate, you know, their good shots. They have to accept their less than perfect shots. They have to accept their misses, and they have to park it and put it behind them and move forward. That's what great athletes do. They live and perform in the moment. Most of us carry our trash with us from shot to shot. And so we're not playing golf. We're playing the game of garbage collection.
What you said, that advice you said, really applies to anybody in any given field, I think. I wanted to pinpoint a couple things you said. Jordan Spieth has been able to handle off the course his ups and downs, I think, in how he handles it, at least in his responses to the media. However, on the course, I think he's just so damn analytical, Doctor, and he just hasn't been able to kind of harness that, the intense determination that he has. You know, I just think he acts out a little too much. I mean, I'm not sure if you ever worked with Jordan Spieth or not, but if you did, what would you say to Jordan Spieth?
Well, the first thing I'd ask Jordan Spieth, I'd say, are you good? And he'd say, well, yes, you know I'm good because I've won major champions. I'm going, well, how did you win them? And he won them by not being so what I would call emotional roller coaster. It seems to me a lot of times he actually acts out. He just becomes very vocal. He verbalizes, and he wears his emotions on his sleeve, which is just fine. But you have to have a little bit of balance in this game. And I think what's happened with Jordan, it happened the same with Tom Watson. It happened with a lot of people who didn't start making a lot of their putts because, you know, everyone expected them to make everything they looked at. And people said, what's going on with you? What's happening? How come you're not putting so well? All of a sudden, you have to look in the mirror at night and go, Jordan, what's going on with you? And that's when you've got a real problem. When you look in the mirror and the guy or woman who looks back at you and goes, well, I'll tell you what's wrong. You stink. You know, you're terrible, all right? That's when you've really got problems, and that's when it really goes bad. But everyone says, what's wrong? What's wrong? Even in our world today of the iPhone, I mean, at the end of the day, when a player, you know, man, woman, boy, or girl comes off the golf course, I mean, the first thing, you know, that phone just blows up. Boop, 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 boop. You know, hey, I thought you were good. I thought you were going to win this tournament. What happened? What? And next thing you know, that's where the seeds of doubt. Everyone just starts, and before long, you commit something called emotional Harry Carey. You just overthink. You're distressed. You know, you become disappointed. And then you look around for answers. And a lot of times, you make a mountain out of a molehill. So that's the first thing I would say, you know, with Jordan. I'd say, what is it you want? Where is it you want to go? And let's find out. Really, let's just take it a little bit easier here, because you know how to play the game. But why are we getting, you know, so emotionally volatile here? But maybe that's how he's acting out, because he's putting so much pressure on himself. Maybe that's what we see. We see the manifestation coming out, you know, of him a little bit. But I got to tell you, I've only run into him a couple of times. He seems like a fantastic person, and he'd be one of the people I would love to have a chance, you know, to sit down and work with and talk through, because I always say this one, the great ones always come back, always. I mean, no matter, you know, if they've been down, and that's the whole point. When you've been at the top of the mountain and you go down to the bottom floor, you're down in the valley. Once you rise back up, you know, on that ascension to the top of the mountain, you appreciate, you know, the view a whole hell of a lot more.
Wow, he is a lovely guy. I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Winters. I'd love for you to sit down with him and have a chat. Remember all the good times, Jordan, and you'll get there. But don't beat yourself up, because you won so quickly out of the gate. His expectations are just way up, as I'm sure they should be, but that must be tough. That's a whole other issue for another show. How do you, you know, handle the highs and lows of this career as, you know, a professional golfer or any professional athlete? That's probably so tough.
Well, it is tough, and I think that's why a lot of athletes, they don't like to retire. I mean, that's a whole new area that a lot of, you know, my colleagues are getting into, is sort of the, you know, the psychological detriment of retiring, because you love the fans, you love the adoration, you love the attention, and then when you're out of the spotlight, you miss, you know, the applause, you miss, you know, the excitement, you miss the adrenaline rush. And for a lot of them, it's hard to step off when you have been at the ultimate peak. And I think somebody who's done this very well, who I've known for many years, who I respect, is Suzanne Pettersen. I mean, she went out, she made that winning putt for the Solheim Cup against Marina Alex. And I mean, that was, she says, this is it. I'm done. You know, I'm a mother. I've achieved this. I've done everything I could in golf. Now I'm going to go out and raise my family and my husband and my kids. I think, you know, she did it. She went out on top. I think Peyton Manning is pretty much the same way. I mean, those are two great examples, is that what else do I have to prove? You know, and then you can look back, and it's the memories that keep you warm after all those years. And people come up to you. People are always great about that. They come up to you and go, hey, remember what, you know, 1994 and all that sort of stuff. So that kind of keeps you warm. But I think what happens to a lot of players, they hang on a little bit too.
More time with you, but we are out of time on this segment of Sports Interview. But it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, we could talk about so much more, but we'll get you on again for part two. How's that?
That would be great, Ann. And thanks so much. And kudos to you and all the success you've had in your career. And I understand, you know, now just sitting down with you, why you've had all that success. Because you make it really simple and make it very easy for us to sit here and talk to you about what we do and how we do it. So thank you for having me on.
Well, you're very compelling. And I could talk sports psychology always. I mean, I love sports, and I love the psychological aspect of sport and what drives the elite athletes and you know, all the issues that elite athletes face, which really on a smaller scale, people every day face. You're talking about self-doubt. You're talking about handling the ups and the downs. You're talking about confidence. These are all traits that, you know, this exists from day to day with every human being. So what we're talking, you know, what you're saying about elite athletes really applies to probably every one of our listeners too. So I appreciate your insight, Dr. Winters. Let's do it again. Have fun here at Bay Hill, your hometown, your home course, and would love to have you on again to talk more sports psychology.
Thanks, Anna. I look forward to it.
Thanks so much. My thanks to Robert Gomez, to Dr. Bob Winters, and to our studio engineer, Kyle Lynch. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, be kind, be happy. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.